We're in our second session of our 4J class entitled American History and the Sexual Revolution. We have five sessions in all, so there's still three more coming after tonight. Last week we considered a broad beginning of time period from about the mid-1800s to 1920-ish, 30s, and saw the change from the evangelical influence culture with the Victorian Moors, from the Great Awakenings in America, the evangelical revivals in England, to then finally the changes that were happening shortly before World War I. And there were some big changes in the cities primarily because of social dislocation and other things. There was a lot of changes. And so that was last week. And we saw a key text in Ezekiel where it says that the sins of that ancient city of Sodom were, first of all, that in their haughtiness and arrogance, they had indulged in pleasure and leisure and not cared for the poor and the needy with those advantages of prosperity, and then had committed acts of detestable nature. And so there was a process that went through their society that Ezekiel explains, and we see the beginnings of that in the 1800s with the prosperity of the Industrial Revolution and the relative peace of the late 1800s up until World War I that really did precipitate a lot of people having, as it were, too much time on their hands. And so that is the occasion then for their reconsidering of, is this really wrong? Is sexual immorality, sexual behavior really wrong outside of marriage?
Where in Ezekiel was that, Bob?
Ezekiel 16, and I think it's verses something like 46, 47, 48, 49, somewhere in there. And just lays it out step by step. I failed to recognize last week and the recording when I was speaking that I leaned heavily on some resources. One of them was a book of essays by Gertrude Himmelfarb, Marriage and Morals in the Victorian Age, and then also George Grant's expose on Planned Parenthood, which is entitled, I think, Grand Illusions. And a booklet that Jeff Pollard, a pastor in Florida, did on modesty and the public undressing of America. And so I used those books and took a lot of facts from them. Tonight, might as well mention the books I'm going to use tonight. I want to give credit where credit's due. The insights like connecting Cain and his private life to his economics, that didn't come from me. That came from Himmelfarb. And actually has a lot more weight when one of the most noted Victorian scholars points it out. And you're like, oh, yes. So the books that I'm using tonight are one by Glenn Altschuler, which is an interesting German name. It means old schooler. But All Shook Up, How Rock and Roll Changed America. And this one by a Catholic scholar who's kind of very controversial figure, and his theses, his main ideas are controversial too, and so there's a good bit of speculation in here, but a wealth of information, and it's E. Michael Jones's Dionysus Rising, and he's got several series on exposés on modernists and their connection to sexual immorality influencing their thinking. Scripture is very clear that our desires influence our thinking. Paul warned Timothy, a pastor, in 2 Timothy that the days will come when people will not endure sound doctrine, but because of their desires, they will accumulate for themselves many teachers, basically will tell them what they want to hear. And so we have our desires. We know what this is like, when we deal with other people, children, or if we're honest, if we watch ourselves and listen to ourselves, we can rationalize things very, very well. and come up with reasons and excuses. And if you're good at this, you can come up with a whole system of thought. And if people join with you, you can develop such things. So Romans also teaches that at the core of not acknowledging God or giving thanks to Him, our hearts grow dark. And professing to be wise, we actually become fools. Because we exchange the truth for a lie, and we refuse to worship God. So man's thinking is not neutral. Our own thoughts are not neutral. And thus, the Bible is very, very clear that we need to watch over our hearts with all diligence. From it flows the springs of life, even our thought processes. So, okay. Again, I am a generalist. I am painting a picture with big brushes. And I am borrowing heavily upon resources. I was born in 1969. My parents were putting together my cradle when the Apollo lander, you know, landed on the moon, okay? And so if you can put me in context there, those of you who remember those days and those of you who witnessed the 1960s, which is our topic tonight, I saw just a tad of it through the bars of my cradle, okay? My crib, all right? This is that was very limited exposure firsthand. But we will try to paint a picture tonight and draw some conclusions. Let me give you the background first of all, again, like we did last week. The 1960s has an interesting international and global background and political one. A lot of political issues, but the Cold War provided the global context. Since Winston Churchill, you know, coined the phrase the Iron Curtain, and Iron Curtain has fallen across Europe. I think it was 1948 or so when he coined that phrase, that the communists had have this block of nations, and then the world was kind of in this standoffish grip between communism and the free world, and the anxiety of you know, the missiles and of a nuclear fallout and such things. And probably the biggest crisis was when the Soviets wanted to put missiles in Cuba and in the early 60s. So there was the space race going on, and how the Soviets put the first satellite in space in 1957, and then you had one series after another culminating in the success of the Apollo program, putting man on the moon in the late 60s, which I just mentioned. That provided the context for Vietnam, which the struggle over Indochina then escalated slowly, one president after another, until it kind of got handed off, until by the late 60s it is a charged political issue, a very debated social issue, and with campuses rioting and not looking good for America by the elections of 1968 for winning it. And so the man who had boasted in his 1965 inauguration that we were the great society and that a society so prosperous could get rid of poverty and that no one, as it were, is left behind, ended his presidency of that term with military escorting and barely leaving the White House. Because he was so not liked. So, assassinations, Martin Luther King Jr., 1968 in the spring, I believe, Robert Kennedy, and rioting associated with that, and interesting escalation of emotions. From the beginning of the era, beginning of that decade, when ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, and the optimism that seemed to be around the corner in a very prosperous and free nation. It seems like there's some parallels to Victorian England and post-Victorian England. In some ways, the Great Depression and World War II seem to put a pause on the cultural developments of America because they were crises of a sort that diverted attention. you can almost skip, in a sense, from the 1920s to the 1950s. And there were a lot of comparisons made in the 1950s to the 20s, explaining how the teens were behaving. The parents were reminded, what did you do when you did the Charleston and such things? And a lot of the comparisons jumped two decades back to the 20s, the last era that saw prosperity and peace and a culture that seemed to be pushing the envelope of cultural norms. So there's this transition from the 20s over to the 50s, and by the time you get to the 60s, you hear echoes of kind of those post-Victorians of, like, we need to be authentic, that our parents' generation held to these external standards but weren't real. And there was a lot of authority and a lot of, like, you got to put your hair this way and you can't dress this way and you can't say certain things, you can't do certain things. And so, like the Victorian, post-Victorians we looked at last week, who were the great-grandchildren of evangelicals, their parents, their grandparents had a morality, had a standard of norms of how to behave, but lacked the fervency of the religion to keep that up. And so the children often were not bequeathed that strong religion that would say there's reasons for why these morals are in place. And so that tension between trying to have a morality without having the strong religion leads to a crisis of authenticity. And the next generation just blows the doors open and says, we just need to be authentic. We still live in that kind of age, even today, of like saying authenticity is such a great virtue. And I'm not convinced it is. Psalm 73 speaks about a crisis of faith, that he said, if I had spoken about these things, I would have betrayed my generation. And there's certain things that it is right to keep hidden because they're shameful. If there's no heart to do it the right way, let us confess that to God and get it right. But why should I be a stumbling block to my neighbor out of a selfish quest to be authentic? That's a good question. And artists in particular who value expression really have to wrestle with those questions, as all of us do. Okay. There's also a jump from the 20s to the 50s in music. The popular music of the eras began with the turn of the century with ragtime, moving into the 1920s with jazz, then into the 40s with rhythm and blues, country and western. One's urban, one's country. and pop music. And the pop music of that early 50s era is, you know, Frank Sinatra, and had a formula that sounded like this. This was advice given in that day. Don't sing out. Croon. Hum. Reflect. Daydream. Wish on a star. Wink at the moon. Laze in the sun. Accentuate the positive. Eliminate the negative. And the popular singers of that day were Bing Crosby and Perry Como, Nat King Cole, and Johnny Mathis. Not very threatening in that regard, it would seem. So the decade opens with that's pop music. Now, country and western won't touch on very much. Rhythm and blues in the urban areas was African American and was of three different varieties. One was the jump music. I'm not exactly sure what that sounded like. One was the doo-wop groups. And the third, though, were the shouters, the R&B shouters, who were much more raunchy in their lyrics and very explicit. Hank Baldwin and the Midnighters had some very blushing lyrics to some of their songs that even caused consternation in the industry, saying, you need to tone this down. Now, I'm just going to pause for a second here. why are we talking about music so much if we're talking about a sexual revolution in American history? The 1960s, it has been said, cannot be explained well without its music. It was such a big part of the emblem and the message of the culture that was rising at the time. And so for this decade, for this year, we're going to talk a lot about music tonight. Please excuse again my lack of expertise. I'm not a musician, and I will refrain from singing tonight. So we have these three kinds of R&B, rhythm and blues varieties. They're the precursors to the rock and roll movement. Rock and roll is something different than rhythm and blues. Even though it owes a lot to rhythm and blues, it is something different. Rhythm and blues was mainly an ethnic manifestation. It was African American in origin and mainly in the cities, and would be played on radio stations that were catered to that audience, though there was a substantial amount of white audience listening in. One L.A. Record store in 1952, which sold R&B records and was in a black neighborhood, reported that 40% of its customers were white, coming in from other neighborhoods. Oftentimes, radio was the means that the other neighborhoods and the white teenagers were listening in to these songs being played and trying to pick up on what was being sung and how it was being done. And so there's beginning to be quite a bit of overplay between the two. The Shouters gained a big technological breakthrough. In the 1940s, Fender put out its first electric guitar. And the electric guitar allowed music to be played loud. And that style of R&B loved it, and hence earned its name. Okay, so you have electric guitar in place. You have a kind of an edgy content and feel to the music being developed, and you have a white audience listening in. The major record companies of the day were catering to the pop singers, but there were a lot of independent labels developing because 45s could be made cheaply. And so these indies were catering to these lesser-known groups and were popping up all over the place. And one of them in Memphis, Tennessee, was developed by Sam Phillips and was named Sun Records. And Sam Phillips was catering purposely to the African-American bands, but he is quoted as saying that if he could find a white man with the Negro sound and the Negro feel, he would make $1 billion. There was a semi-juvenile delinquent type in the Memphis neighborhoods listening in on these radio stations, putting his hair in a very protruded style and wearing pink and black, his favorite colors, and being very much a loner, but playing music. And he tried out, and first you don't succeed, try and try again. It was not the first time he succeeded. It didn't just click and click, but he picked up a 1946 Arthur Craddock blues song and sang it for Phillips, and a couple other men joined in, and it perked his attention, and Elvis Presley had his first hit. This would be released, I believe, in 1954. The question was, what is it? Some people, when they played it on the radio, said it's too country and western to be played after 5 a.m. And others said it's way too Negro in feel. And they couldn't figure out what is it. And it's interesting to me. It seems like rock and roll. In this book, there's several cases like this in the 1950s of a song that charted number one in country and western and in R&B on both charts. Hound Dog was one of those. Because, and it seems like that this is rock and roll, where it takes from the rhythm and blues background of the African-American community, but it puts white singers, some of them white, some of them black, into it and creates a new mix. And so rock and roll is more of a universal development in music, it would appear, than is just that more ethnic R&B. So...
get in the middle of the lecture thing, but I'd like to bring out a little bit more about how Elvis was the first individual for the whites that was doing that, but there were many of the black people that were influencing the white kids drastically, and the parents didn't like it. They really did not like what was going on, and these black musicians were out there just rocking these kids, and they were digging it. They really liked it. Then along comes Sam and that idea with Elvis. You know, you had it right, but it was a lot bigger in that black scene, and they did not like the idea that these black, greasy, grungy artists were influencing these white kids.
Correct.
That was a real big thing back then.
So. That's exactly right. Yeah. Altshuler writes that whites had long reified black culture as the perpetually fascinating but for real, alluring but alarming, sensual but sordid antithesis to the dominant white one. Rhythm and blues gave them nightmares. That their teenagers would live out the fantasy described by Jack Kerouac in On the Road. At lilac evening, I walked with every muscle aching among the lights of 27th and Welton in the Denver colored section, wishing I were Negro, feeling that the best the white world had offered was not enough ecstasy for me, not enough life, joy, kicks, darkness, music, not enough night. And so... echoing what you're saying, as that was the feel, the tension of the day. That urban black culture represented a more racy, pardon the pun, but a more risque lifestyle. It symbolized that. Not every individual did it, but it symbolized that to many people in the white neighborhoods and became then something to be shunned. Which the singers that then came along afterwards crossed over, as it were, and created a wider audience. The problem was that Elvis was also, I mean, he and other singers were also very disturbing. Elvis's stage presence, described by his own publicist, a woman, he's basically a male striptease act, but he keeps his clothes on. And that was the way she described what went on stage. And the audience of teenagers, a lot of them being young ladies, it's almost like legendary how spastic they went in that sense. And so something sparked in the midst of all that was very sexual in nature. And it was... a big question on the networks: do we like put Elvis before the television and have him sing on these variety shows or not? Steve Allen, one of the big acts, big names at that time, actually invited Elvis to sing, but required that he, you know, tame himself. When he sang Hound Dog, they actually brought out a basset hound. He held it in his arms and kissed it a couple times. But when he started to wiggle, the camera zoned in on him only to see the top part of Elvis in order to keep the rest out of view. Elvis is tame compared to Jerry Lee Lewis, though. Jerry Lee Lewis grew up in Louisiana and in a home with a drunk dad and a devout Assemblies of God mother, the dad claiming to be Christian. And Jerry Lee lived with that divided self for a lot of his life. So did his cousin, Jimmy Swaggart. And Jimmy Swaggart being very famous for his scandalous behavior in the late 80s. But Jerry Lee wanted to go into ministry and even went to school for 3 months, but would sneak away from the dorms to go to Dallas and live it up in the night scene. And so most of his life was this. I read it very disturbingly, his life, because he would go back and forth between indulging in sexual immorality and then just lashing himself and beating himself up with self-hatred and self-loathsome, only then to then, once that kind of was satisfied, to go right back into sexual immorality again and lived with that, even in the midst of recording very scandalous tunes. A whole lot of shaking going on was one that made him very famous. But a man actually wrote a song with him in mind, and it was Great Balls of Fire. And that song is more... In this era, by the way, things are not explicit. There's a lot of suggestion that goes on regarding what's being referred to. The explicit nature, I've been told, the explicit rock and roll of exact, more describing things. I've heard that, you could correct me on this, that Rod Stewart with Maggie was the first one that like described, sleeping over and all this kind of thing. And it gets more and more explicit as you go on in time. But the suggestions of the day were definitely caught by the audience and the listeners. And so you had Jerry Lee Lewis. He was a famous singer in that time period. Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry. I did not realize that Maybelline in 1955, I think it was actually a country and western song named Ida Red from the 40s that then got named after a mascara box that was on the floor. Let's call it Maybelline and change the spelling so there's no lawsuit involved. But Chuck Berry had several hits in that time period. The last one, probably his biggest one, being Johnny Be Good. But he combined things of gospel tradition with Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll in one of his songs, I think called School Days. Fats Domino, Ain't That a Shame. He became a millionaire. He was true R&B. The most popular singer that era, though, by the way, based on sales, was Pat Boone. Pat Boone gave vanilla versions of the African American songs, and so he would purge the lyrics and sanitize them and make them squeaky clean so that teenagers could have fun but not sin. And was a professing Christian, and I don't think that's actually a good approach to countering a youth culture. So we need to just provide them with fun. Because Ezekiel tells me, what we saw last week, that after having fun for a while and just living for myself, I'm going to start looking for other things that are not so moral. And so that's just a stopgap measure. It has to be deeper than that. Morality has to be based on religion again. If you don't catch that, that's going to be a big theme. Morality has to be based on religion. And the fear of God is how we perfect holiness, the Bible says. So, anyways, the song Tutti Frutti is a good illustration of this. Little Richard Penniman was an R&B shouter and had a very confused sexual life. His Tutti Frutti original could have peeled the paint off the walls with some of its words and how he sang it in concert with taking the Lord's name in vain and swearing and different things. When he came to the studio, the producer said, "We can't have that. It would not sell in that time period at all. And so we need to rewrite the lyrics." So he called in a 21-year-old female, African-American female, to rewrite the lyrics. Little Richard was so embarrassed, he could not sing it to her. He had to turn and face the wall to be able to sing the lyrics of the song in order for her to get the idea of how the song goes. And in an afternoon, she wrote the lyrics that are most famous that have been replayed again and again. When Pat Boone got the song, he even scrubbed down those lyrics and had a whole different set for his Tutti Frutti version. So you can kind of see how it goes from that R&B culture, rock and roll, and then your sanitized, squeaky clean vanilla versions. The other one, while we're talking about this, the other personage at that time period that's of that kind of venue is Dick Clark. And I always heard of Dick Clark when I was growing up as like America's oldest teenager, the guy that never ages. So he had American Bandstand, which I think gave his network 5% of their revenues. It was a highly successful show. But he absolutely required very strict dress, very limited speech, very the kind of dancing and everything was like in order to continue to cater to his audience, which include housewives and others. Rock and roll did not last that long in that time period. It kind of had a meteoric, you know, like rise and explosion, and some of the songs being very, you know, more of the scandalous nature, some of them not. By the end of the decade, there was accusations of bribery in the payola scandal, where little indie record companies were paying disc jockeys to play their record. It was done all across the industry and was accepted practice, but somebody blew the whistle. And so disc jockeys were fired, radio stations quit doing that, and so the little indie stations that had the new, fresh rock and roll couldn't get their records played as much. So there's a lull in the development of that movement from about 1959 to 62-63. Also within that time period, Elvis Presley gets drafted and goes into the military. Chuck Berry gets arrested and goes to prison for a couple years. A plane crash in Iowa takes care of the Big Bopper, Ritchie Valens, and Buddy Holly. And so it's like a brief 4 or 5 year kind of like envelope in which there's this big punch. Oh, by the way, I forgot one song. Forgot a couple things to mention. This is disjointed, but that's okay. One is that the anthem, the first anthem of that era, sung by Bill Haley, am I pronouncing right? Bill Haley in the comments. Yeah. Rock Around the Clock was a flop when it first came out as a single. But when it got used as a theme song for Blackboard Jungle, a movie about juvenile delinquency, then it like skyrocketed in sales. I think it went to 2 million in sales. The other is that the name rock and roll was coined by a disc jockey who called himself Moondog, and the Moondog Show, something like that, was his show. But he got sued because some other guy claimed he had the Moondog name first. And so he changed it to the Rock and Roll Party. And that's Alan Freed. He also was a casualty of the payola scandal. It utterly decimated his career. He was done, even though he was like top dog DJ in New York City. Rock and roll came back in a strange direction with the British invasion in 1964 and 65. England, before rock and roll, England was lacking freshness in popular music. It lacked a lot of the ethnic diversity of America. You don't have a southern culture, you don't have a black culture, you don't have a lot of things in England. So when these records started showing up, the rock and roll records in the late 50s in England, bands developed like overnight. Liverpool alone had 200 plus by the early 60s. And one of those bands owed a ton to Buddy Holly. That was the Beatles. The first the first song they recorded was That'll Be the Day. The first 40 that Paul McCartney wrote and John Lennon were based on Buddy Holly's music. It's like he found the recipe for success, and they kept working it and working it and working it. And so when the British came over and their bands came over in the early, the first, 64 or whatever, they actually brought American music back to America in that sense. And then the rest of the story I'll tell later on. Developments happened quickly after that point, and things looked quite radically different in some sense than the 1950s. Okay, that's the background. Let me ask the question. So let's look at some meaning. So that kind of gives the story. There's three things I want to mention about the meaning. The first is that rock and roll is a form of popular, meaning of the people, music. Popular is from the Latin word for people. It's people-driven. It's consumer-driven music. This is a basically popular anything. Pop culture is a product of the Industrial Revolution. You have to mass produce something to get pop culture, because the masses, the people, have to be able to buy a lot of it. And so in some sense, pop culture begins with the Industrial Revolution in the early 1800s. Let me give you an example. When ragtime is popular, and then in the 19-teens, sheet music was very, very big business for people to sing around their piano at home, to buy it. The record companies of the 1920s pretty much wiped out their market, because now you could get these rolls and on your Victrola, and you could play it without having to play it. So in gospel music, if you're familiar with the church and familiar with the gospel hymn tradition of Ira Sankey and P.P. Bliss and, In the Garden and the Old Rugged Cross, it's also a product of popular music. I mean, they were writing hits, in a sense. And so popular music, the very idea of popular music, depends on sales. Whatever gets the most sales, everybody looks and says, that was the most popular. It's the gauge. And it actually works both ways, because what you pump gets more sales. And sometimes it can be artificially stimulated, like when Dick Clark played 16 Candles, a billion times on American Bandstand, in part because he had stock in that record company label of that song. And there's an interplay between the two. So, pop music, rock and roll is a form of pop music. An illustration of that fact is the Ozzie and Harriet Nelson show, which was a television show of the 1950s. And it had Ozzie and Harriet, the dad and the mom, and then the two brothers, the two sons, David and Ricky. And Ozzie was a shrewd businessman. He recognized that in the late 50s, rock and roll will sell. And so he enlisted his son, Ricky, who liked the music and sang the music in the bathroom and only knew one song on the guitar. He enlisted him and put him in front of the camera, and he sang. And of course, overnight, there's Ricky Nelson fan clubs, and there's sales and all this stuff, and it's very lucrative business. To retain his adult audience, the father had Ricky not move or twitch a muscle. And when he sang his love songs, he closed his eyes. There's no hint of anything bad going on here. This is safe, rock and roll music. And you can encourage your teen to buy this in that sense. And you can continue to watch our show. And it was wildly successful in that sense. I remember seeing Ricky Nelson in a John Wayne movie of that time period, Rio Lobo. I think it was Rio Lobo. Anyways, and with Dean Martin and Like, it's weird to see singers show up in these cowboy westerns, you know. But that was kind of a thing then, too. So, the first thing, what makes rock and roll so successful at the time period? Well, one is money. It's interesting to watch these, like, you know, Ed Sullivan show or the Steve Allen show or even Frank Sinatra's thoughts about Elvis. When they first come out, they're like, you know, but after a while, this is business, you know. And so you kind of get reconciled to these things and you make amends a little bit and you collaborate a little and you make a buck together. And so money moves and motivates people. And if you're familiar with the Bible, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, of harm. So in the tug of war between what's good for our teens, what's good for our families, what's good for our culture, and then making a dollar, it was not always the case that what was good for the culture won out. And riding the lucrative rock and roll train, as it were, became pretty popular among the publishers and the TV producers and such things. So money is a big part of what's behind this. It's a form of popular music. A second reason why rock and roll was popular is the invention of adolescence. This is a more deeper concept. The word teenager and the word adolescent were developments of the 20th century. In 1904, a psychologist, I think it's or sociologist, G. Stanley Hall, published a book called Adolescence, with a long title after that. You know, it's this, it's that, it's the other thing. But he was an evolutionist that viewed the human being as recapitulating the stages of evolution. If you've ever seen his drawings that he used from a German guy, like on the womb and the recapitulations of the stages of, you know, evolution from, you know, fish and bird and all this stuff. They show, like, you know, there's gill slits on the embryo and all these things, which things have been, you know, now that we have technology, have been shown to be false. But it was one of those clever ideas that kind of makes sense, you know. So when they're little kids, they're in the pre-savage stages of civilization. And then when they're grade school children, they're savages, you know. But then when they're adolescents, you know, you have to treat them based on their stages of human civilization development. And he coined this idea of adolescence. Adolescence in Latin just means growing up. It was a time period where they really got to grow up into being adults. Before this time period, though, you went from being a child to an adult. Paul said, when I became a man, I did away with childish things. You know, you're a child, then you're a man. And yes, you could be a young man, young woman, but you're still an adult. This idea of adolescence is this gap period where now I think we could define it as an adult body with a child mind is an adolescent, okay, lacking the responsibility to handle the adult abilities. This time period of adolescence was viewed so critical to human development among the sociologists and educators that it needed to be separated from the years prior and the years to come, from the children and the adults. And the chief institution that established that separation is the high school. At the turn of the century, at 1900, a fraction of American population, about 10%, goes to high school. I think you know many of your grandparents, great-grandparents, you know, they quit at eighth grade, right? You know, my grandpa did. I'm sure you have relatives like that. It was not uncommon. Eighth grade education, you're working. And if you go to colonial America, that kind of, right that age, 14 or whatever, you're going to college or you're working or you're apprenticing. You're doing adult responsibilities. It's expected of you in society. But now, from 1900, where 10% go to high school, 1940 were 75%, to the late 50s where 87% go to high school, you have a huge population block isolated by itself, that develops its own sense of identity. We are a people. The word teenager was not even coined till 1941. First appears in a Reader's Digest article. But when you get to the 1950s, you have movies about the teenager. You have songs by teenagers, sung for teenagers, about teenagers. And it's a culture in its own self, and it's got money. It's got allowances, and it's got little responsibilities to spend it on. And so records were bought by the millions. The music industry catered largely to the teenage population of the 1950s. If there was not such a category, a class of people, it is questionable whether rock and roll would have taken off, because it definitely catered to that time, that subculture and group. That subculture developed a language of its own, a dress of its own, music obviously of its own, and so it had all the cultural traits of being its own people. This, by the way, tells us the importance. We cannot get rid of these institutions, by the way. I mean, the high school is here, and adolescence as a concept has actually not shrunk but enlarged. There are people that are quite alarmed, actually, by the lateness of development for singles in our culture. That it's like, why has it even increased, not even decreased? Actually, in the 1950s, there were a lot of late teen marriages. That was very common, in part due to the mores of the time that required sexuality to be within marriage. So, I'm just going back again. It is important for us in developing ways that help, call them teens, but young adults, take responsibilities, be integrated with adults, and in adult conversations and adult worlds. I appreciate, for example, how our church does both. We have time slots for a teen and for a youth group, but we have many things in which they're integrated. They're in our search classes, they're in our small groups, talking, just with even our children are. And I appreciate that about our church, because it helps foster continuity with the adult world and with more mature topics of conversation and goal setting than just, she broke up with me, I'm living in Heartbreak Hotel, I can't believe how lonely I am, you know, and topics like that. There's a ton of songs like that at that time period. They're all over the place. Now, there's another... Okay, so there's money involved, there's a teen culture, there's an audience, because you can't make the money if there's no market. So these actually go together. Another thing that... Well, okay. I think the biggest reason, though, and the thing, I think it's in the music. These are external things, but I think the music carries its own power. There is something in the style of rock and roll that is alluring. It was to me, and it still is to me. Maybe it is to most Americans today. I mean, I was born in 1969. Most of us, you know, we grew up in that. It was there already. There's something in it that is definitely alluring. I remember a song in the 1980s by Huey Lewis and the News. You know, it's the heart of rock and roll is the beat. And that was the whole song, was describing that. And it's the thing that's most obvious is the rhythm and the beat. Other things get included and thrown in. I'm going to call it this tonight. I'm going to say, the music has the potential for passion. Maybe even, let's say, the power for passion. And I'm using passion in a classical sense of the word. our culture right now has trivialized the word passion, like we've done awesome. Everything's awesome. Two scoops of ice cream on your cone is awesome. Well, the classical sense of the word awesome mean it struck fear in your heart and terror. You know, we're a long ways from that, all right? And so we use passion now for anybody that's earnest. You know, he's passionate or sincere. You know, he's got a passion for his job. He's got a passion. But in the classical sense of the word, it's like the passion of Christ, the sufferings of Christ. Passion like passive, something done to me versus active, something I do. So if in the classical sense of the word passion, if I'm in passion mode, I'm being operated upon, I'm no longer in control. And there are two strong passions that often show up in the human psyche. One is sexual desire, and the other is anger. Those are more classical passions. Interestingly enough, they both show up in the life of Samson. He is an angry, sexually driven man in the remarkableness of things that God uses to defeat a foreign power or start defeating the Philistines. These two things, rock and roll has demonstrated an ability to speak to those states of spirit or psyche in the human being. Music is a language of the human soul. It can express attitudes, outlooks, things that we would put adjectives and labels on, but it can express it in an amazing way. If you ever doubt that, take your hymnal out, if you're a churchgoer, take your hymnal out and find hymns that have the same meter. A big one is, like, let's say 11, 11, 11, 11. So you take "How Firm a Foundation," "Immortal, Invisible, God Only Wise," "My Jesus, I Love Thee," are in that hymn, in that way. So is "Away in a Manger." And if you ever take the lyrics, because they'll match the meter of the tune, take the lyrics of "How Firm a Foundation" and try to sing it to "Away in a Manger." And it will feel ludicrous to you. Because it's like, that's a lullaby. And it speaks of serene, quiet, small things. "How Firm a Foundation" or "Immortal, Invisible, God Only Wise" speaks of big things. Music communicates a state of mind. Maybe that's why King Saul in the Old Testament needed David to play the harp to chase away an evil spirit and a state of mind that haunted him. Or why Elisha needed a minstrel to calm down in order to be able to prophesy when the kings had dragged him out to what looked like an utter defeat situation. And he needed the minstrel in order to prepare his spirit to prophesy. Rock and roll has the potential or power for passion to conjure up a state of sexual orientation or of anger. It doesn't have to. I'm saying it has a power to. And as a music, it is definitely adept to this. Proof of that is if a performer isn't like Ricky Nelson and required to stand still, but like Elvis Presley is allowed to be free, the kind of things that are expressed naturally by the music, or the kind of lyrics that are expressed naturally by those tunes, other tunes maybe not, but by those tunes, show the integrity of it. And I doubt, and I'm arguing this, but I doubt that if you take and squeaky clean the lyrics, but still retain that tune played in its original strong fashion, I doubt you take away that mindset that the tune embodies or would suggest. I was a music connoisseur when I was a teenager. I mean, I'd make my brother buy it. This is a shameful thing. I'd make my brother buy it and then dub it. I'd recommend a band and then he'd spend his money and then I'd dub it. I felt so guilty of this as a young man. I spent like $400 in one shot. at the record company that I would have bought these from, feeling like I gotta like pay you something for all this collection of music that I have, you know. And forgive me, Ryan, if you're listening to this. And my music styles got harder and harder and faster the older I got in my teen years and such. When I was newly married in my early 20s, I wanted to come up with like a romantic cassette, you know, just to have on hand, you know, kind of thing. And so I remember while doing my engineering homework, you know, that's really stimulating stuff there, having my radio over here with my little cassette recorder, so if a song came on, I could hit the record button, you know? And so I was listening to those oldies stations. And I was familiar with oldies. I mean, it were in our household. I mean, I knew the songs. I owned a Chuck Berry. You know, I owned Chuck Berry. I owned Elvis Presley, the Four Tops from Motown and different things, and I'd seen them on. You know, I had a lot of this knowledge as well as the current stuff and things that I knew of. So I remember catching these songs that would come on, you know, and we don't need to list them out. After 1 week of doing just 1 week, I was so tempted by sexual desire because I wasn't used to it. I was like, this is a wake up. This is interesting to me. Like, wow, where'd that come from? And I realized this is coming from that, which I considered in my time, this is safer. I mean, when I went to college, the Wilson Singers were singing, you know, all I want to do is make love to you. I mean, we're talking about more explicit lyrics. These are the oldies and goodies, you know, like, and I was like, wow. I had a similar experience in movies. When I was in college in my sophomore year, I was like so, I was busy all the time. I hardly ever watched a movie. I came home at Thanksgiving, watched one action film. I used to watch the, you know, shoot 'em up films all the time as a teenager. I watched one and had nightmares that night. Because I didn't realize how desensitized I had come to that whole experience. And this is what happens. We get used to it. And I, you know, you talk to teens or you talk to people and they say, I don't listen to lyrics. You know, and in actuality, they probably don't really much. It's part of their backgrounds, part of their life. But it's in there. It gets in. Anyways, that was eye-opening to me. It's in the music. It has a potency and a power to do this, to arouse passion of some sorts. The other style of music that I listened to, that I listened to a lot of metal music. It was the late 80s and 90s. It was late 80s when I listened to that. The first time I listened to one of those bands, it was like the first time somebody takes a cigarette. I was like, oh, that's awful. I was like, you know, a sophomore in high school. But I got desensitized, and it wasn't long before it was like I wanted harder and harder. I wanted to be a strong, you know, tough man. And I wanted tough music. And so all, everything and anything I could get my hands on basically was like, of styles, was in that time period in my life. But I remember, you know, I'd sing those songs and I'd get in front of, when nobody's around, you know, get in front of a mirror, you know, and then mouth those lyrics and go, like this, you know, like, you know, and then the deep, you know, kind of anger and resentment that was in me, you know, towards this or that going on in my life was like, you know, and I can still, those songs are like right there for me. I can hear one, you know, in Subway, you know, it's like now in me for a week. It's like, how do I get this out of me, you know? I mean, it's like, but I know that it was like, it's that, you know, one German verb was really interesting, had that beat. I learned all these, you know, I learned German in high school. And you had to learn the principal parts. Binden, bank, gebunden. Just sounded like heavy metal beat, you know. Binden, bank, gebunden, you know. That's like, anyways. So, there's something, when you haven't had this opportunity, and this is like, it's present and there, it's like, I want to hear that again. That was powerful stuff. There was power in those, some of those tunes. And that's the thing that's interesting to me, I think is the thing that is a caution to us. 1 Thessalonians tells us that we should know how to possess our own vessel in sanctification and honor. Not, and this verse highly convicted me as a young man because I didn't do it, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who don't know God. Lustful passion being operated upon by a strong desire like the Gentiles who don't know God. They don't know God, and that's the music that they produce in large part because they don't know God. And so Great Balls of Fire can be their song, but should it be my song? There's a lot of fresh new songs written that are not passion, that are not that way. I'm not putting down new music versus old music and all this stuff. But I'm saying, as part of this series, American History and the Sexual Revolution, that the potency, the power for passion that's in rock and roll was a big part of that movement. The name itself, rock and roll, is a euphemism for sexual activity. It had been first used in a song that we know of in 1922 among the urban black culture. And was readily used that way in the later era in songs. And so you still hear it used that way. I talked about the antics on stage and different things. The antics off stage also put in question the propriety of the music. Chuck Berry went to prison because of a 14-year-old that he was accused of bringing across state lines for immoral purposes. Maybe not guilty of it, but it was a 14-year-old that he brought back, 14-year-old girl. Elvis Presley met a 14-year-old girl in Germany while he was a private. He had the astuteness enough not to marry her until 7 years later when it wasn't scandalous. Jerry Lee Lewis was horrible, was not so careful in his abilities in marriage. He had 6 marriages in all. The third one was to his 13-year-old cousin, who when he brought to England and lied about her age and they found out what the age was, they heckled him as cradle robber and different things, and the whole tour was canceled, and that scandal ruined his career for the time being. So the lifestyles off stage, the antics on stage, the lyrics that are being sung, and the way it's making things happen in the culture and stuff, this is part of the argument that this is a big part of the sexual revolution in our country. The anger, passion, was present in the 1950s. There was, you know, reports of this or that, roughhousing and things at concerts and stuff, but didn't show up in force until the next decade. And it's interesting that when you go to, it's like if you play Hound Dog or Great Balls of Fire, and then you play the Rolling Stones, I Can't Get No Satisfaction, which I heard for the first time, I think, when I was in sixth grade. I was like, I think I recorded it. I was like, wow. You know, I mean, it had a deep, deep driving guitar underneath it for its time period. And then the antics and the stage behavior of Mick Jagger and how they basically, to save his life, they had a helicopter ready sometimes after concerts. Something major changed. It was present, but something heightened by the end of the 60s in a lot of the styles of music. It's interesting that the illegal activity that Mick Jagger was doing put him on trial in 1967. The same culture that just 7 years, 8 years earlier had heckled Jerry Lee Lewis off the island capitulated to the popularity of the Rolling Stones and Mick Jagger, and on the last day possible of that trial, he was set free, and nothing was ever prosecuted against him. that shows a change in public decency and morality and what was allowed. By the time you get to Jim Morrison and the Doors, their name taken from a book by Aldous Huxley about drugs, self-proclaimed, you know, erotic politicians who upheld everything of disorder and chaos, perhaps in part of their stage persona, still pretty risky to promote such things, you realize that there's a lot more chaotic things being pushed. Steppenwolf, Born to Be Wild, is credited as the first heavy metal song, and I think is in 1969. And so by the time you get to the 70s, with the hard rockers, AC/DC and other groups like that, and Ozzy Osbourne and the Black Sabbath, and things on stage that were being done, it is very scandalous, and yet it still continues to go on. The culture has changed, and the authorities have no power at this point to do anything about it because the people want it. It's popular music. It looked for a time that that music went away. In the early 80s, pop music was king, Michael Jackson and such things, and glam metal and pop metal and all this makeup on these long-haired musicians. But in 1987, I think it was, the largest selling debut album of all time came out by a group from California named Guns N' Roses called Appetite for Destruction. And I remember as a college student opening up that album, and it was a CD at the time, and seeing the graphic art in it of a woman raped and bloodied and just slouched in an alley, and thinking to myself, what is this? And yet, I mean, that's just the song I was going to mention. I know the riff, the beginning and opening riff of that song is one of the most powerful, haunting ways to begin a song that I've ever heard in my lifetime, and that's Welcome to the Jungle. And they had the number one song of that time period, Sweet Child of Mine. It didn't go away. The potency for violence, the sex of Paradise City that was on that island and on that album, I mean, and such, it didn't go away, and it's still potent. It's still a potent power to this day. The Church of Jesus Christ needs to be very discerning in its music tastes. You can't take a song like Welcome to the Jungle and squeaky clean it Pat Boone style and have Slash still play it or the original soundtrack and say, I can put new words to this and we can make it just safe, clean, fun for the kids. There is something majorly potent, powerful in it. It sounds ominous, really ominous. When the Beatles sang in the mid-60s, came to America, there's a picture in this book of them at Shea Stadium in 1965. The New York Times said that their act was like 100 power elixir, and that made Elvis Presley look like dandelion tea. In searching for an analogy, a recent historical analogy to the phenomenon of controlling a whole group of such nature and moving a group, I mean a massive crowd of people on that size. The only thing that recent memory had like that was Adolf Hitler's youth rallies and such before the World War. Being able to control a mass of people, that's power. What's interesting is it's a power that even goes beyond the musicians. After Woodstock in 1969, apparently, you know, had been calm, though it lacked all facilities for bathroom. They had to call in 50 doctors just to handle the medical concerns. Later that year, at an abandoned racetrack in California, at Altamont or whatever, the Rolling Stones put on a free concert with Santana leading and Jefferson Airplane, when the Hell's Angels bikers were the bodyguards, and it just became a mayhem. And the singers would break off and say, let's just cool it. But they could not control the crowd. And the problem was they only had a certain kind of music they could play. And so the final song, which is the hit song of the Stones at that time, was Sympathy for the Devil. And that was the exact wrong song to pick for the situation. It shows that there is a power, potency in this, especially in mass meetings, that is that is culturally revolutionary. Jones has the thesis in his book that Wagner struck upon the idea, Richard Wagner, after a failed political revolution, that you could have a successful cultural revolution with music. Friedrich Nietzsche, he claims, picked up on that idea, thought Wagner had failed to follow through, but saw in the Dionysus orgies of the Greeks that music could be used in that way, coupled with mind-altering chemicals. Those kind of things are picked up in the 60s, especially by thinkers and others who mingle with these groups. And so combined with Eastern religions and other things becomes, like Jim Morrison of the Doors, is a nihilism. There's no meaning to life, so if everything's destroyed and the order's destroyed, what does it matter? I don't know. I'm not knowledgeable enough to judge Jones's thesis and to say yes or no on it. But my conclusion after having, you know, just looked at these things is, one is, I think we're a desensitized culture. If things were to happen now, and I'm sure they do in a certain sense, they're not news anymore. The barriers have been broken. The gates have been kicked down. It's like, you know, it's like one teen on Facebook posted a couple years ago, he thought the music of the 80s was great and Guns N' Roses was wonderful. You know, and it's like, it's kind of passé at this point because it's all history. To be an alternative culture, to be salt and light in the culture, visible and different, the church needs to develop its own style of music that's still speaking the idiom, using a guitar. That's the musical instrument of the day. It's great. But that has to be very careful about the potency and the power for passion. Because to a greater or lesser degree, most of us in this room are unaware of the power of that music over us, and we like it. I know a pastor who's a friend of mine that's like all the music he likes. He really likes that kind of driving, energetic, potent, semi-resentful, angry, can like kind of music. I've seen it, I believe, show up in sermons, in the style and way it's preached. It's pervasive. And so this can be part of our topic of conversation tonight as we take a break and resume. But I appreciate this, you listening to this portrait and this sketch. And so may the Lord give us wisdom. And we'll take a break right now and then come back and we can discuss some things. Thank you.